Here we go. Hi, guys. Today I've got a very, very special guest, Aki Mutali. Hi, Aki. How are you?
I'm doing great. Great. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. I first noticed you. I'm not exactly sure in what context, but I saw one of your articles, one of your infamous or famous The Nation articles, and of course, you've written many, and that's how you entered the Gadfather's radar, and I started reading your stuff, and I thought, boy, I've got to have this courageous lady on the show. Maybe you could start by telling us very briefly about sort of your personal history, whether it be your religious history, your ethnic history, and then how you came to the fight that you're involved in right now.
So I'm from Sri Lanka, the northern province of Jaffna, and I lived there for until I was about 6 years old, and then my family and I, because of the civil war, we had to flee, and we landed in Canada back in 1993, and so that's 22, 23 years now. And it's been amazing 23 years, and so basically, when it comes to religion, I had always been skeptical. My mom, she tried to, she would take me to the temple, and because we come from a Hindu background, she'd take me to the temple, try to get me to sing all these songs to each and every single god, like Shiva, Krishna, Durga, and everybody. And it just never really registered with me because I had always asked her so many questions to the point where she just stopped trying. She stopped trying to make me a good little Hindu girl. Yeah. So yeah, I had always questioned religion, and I was lucky enough to not have religion imposed in the household as strongly, I should say, as strongly as a majority of Hindu households. So yeah, since I was a little girl, I had never stopped questioning religion, and I was kind of conditioned because I'm a girl, a South Asian girl. I was definitely conditioned to respect religion, all religions, no matter how I felt about them. And I guess in my late teens, I just kind of lost it because of of all the bigotry from the Middle East to South Asia and what was happening in my country. It was all because of religion. Religion is a very dangerous idea. And the fact that people are worshiping these dangerous ideas, it should be concerning to a lot of people, and it deserves no respect. And that's the narrative that I'm basing my voice on, when it comes to religion. And I'm happy that people are listening. So,
And so how has your family responded to first your official non-belief coming out as a non-believer, but then if you like, as an active proponent of non-belief, right? I mean, in your criticism of religion, you're doing more, you're being more proactive than simply saying, I will be quiet in my non-belief. You're being active in attacking certainly your family's beliefs, if not many other people's beliefs. Has there been a schism within the context of your family, or have they accepted it and moved on?
They kind of accepted it and moved on. But my mom, she's a little bit concerned about my criticism of Islam because of the threats and the danger involved in criticizing
But
Islam.
sorry, clearly she
But
must be misinformed about Islam because Islam is a religion of peace, so she must be wrong.
exactly,
Yeah,
right? My mom, she's very misinformed. So she's the only concern she has is the dangers involved. And other than that, she's like, "All right, go do your thing," you know?
So in her heart, she's a true feminist, right? I mean, she's
Yes.
okay, very nice. Now, have you, so since let's kind of explore your mom's concern. Have you received any spooky threats or dangerous threats, or has it largely been sort of hate mail and so on?
I have received a lot of threats. In one of my articles about the niqab, this person called me. First he threatened to rape me and my mother and kill us. And then he proceeded to accuse me of being an Indian spy.
Right. At the service of the Zionist space.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, it was very unsettling,
Yes.
you know, because the mere mention of rights for women, Muslim women, compelled a person to send these messages to me, and it
Right.
was left under the comments section of my article. And I do receive some fan mails as well, and they're interesting because they go out of their way to tell me how Islam is a religion of peace.
Yes.
And sometimes sometimes what I do is I take screenshots of certain verses from the Quran, and I reply to them. So
Yes.
how do you explain
Oh,
this?
because you don't speak Arabic, that's why.
That's
There's
right.
nuance. Kill, 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 kill in Arabic actually means caress with love. So that's why, because
Yes.
you don't get Arabic. I speak Arabic, so I know that kill means to love.
To love and to
Yeah.
hug and
Yes.
yeah. And so but then I never get any response. You know, they don't reply back to me once I show them these verses. And that's when I know that they really don't believe that it's a religion of peace. It's merely like an expression to shut people up.
Yes.
Just stop criticizing my religion because I call it the religion of peace, and therefore you are wrong.
Right.
Facts don't matter to these
Yes.
people.
Yes.
And there isn't much you can do when people reject fact, right?
Now, have you in your, wonderful writings and so on, have you been able to alter someone's beliefs, either by them being exposed to your writings or by engaging them, or are you batting zero for a thousand?
That's a very good question. Some people have messaged me on Twitter saying that based on my articles, they were able to see some of the systemic abuses under Islam. But then they still maintain the fact that, you know, Islam is a religion of peace. But at the same time, they kind of said, you know, like, okay, look, I didn't know about this before. And thank you for informing me. And they seemed a little bit knowledgeable,
Right.
you know, at that point. But I would not say that I was able to fully convert them
Right.
into the light.
You know, I mean, I face these types of battles of ideas, not only in my criticisms of religion in general, but of all sorts of poor reasoning, right? I mean, people engage in shoddy reasoning in all sorts of contexts outside of religion and certainly outside of a specific criticism of Islam. So, for example, when I In my scientific work, when I'm trying to, for the past 20 years, to introduce evolutionary psychology and biology in the social sciences in general and in consumer behavior in particular, again, I get very sort of religious-like dogma that resists the ideas that I'm proposing, right? Because if somebody has been vested within a paradigm for 25 years of their scientific career where they reject that biology matters, and then you come along and say, but surely you must concede that humans are biological beings. Surely biology has something to do with our behaviors. Well, it's very hard for them to accept that perhaps some of the positions that they've held are just irrevocably incorrect. And so, in a sense, my battle, I mean, yes, sure, I'd like to criticize religion in general and some religions more than others, but I'm really about fighting for truth and fighting against bad ideas. And so some of the resistance that you see in your own work, you'll also see it in non-religious contexts because people don't wish to have their favorite ideologies challenged, right?
Exactly,
Yeah.
exactly. And that causes them to to display their bigotry.
Right.
It's not enough that they believe in bigotry. They have to now display it
right.
through methods of violence and just plain belligerence,
right.
you know?
Now, let me ask you this. So one of the things that I've discussed both privately and publicly is the idea that, people are very apathetic about getting involved, right? They think, somebody else will do this. Somebody else will fight the battle. It's not for me to weigh in. And yet, here you are, somebody who otherwise, you're not a politician, you're not an academic, right? You're somebody who decided, look, I've got a voice and I'm going to find a medium where hopefully my voice could be heard. Now, clearly that comes from your personhood. You're somebody who somehow has the right personality to be engaged. But how do you get others who don't also have the relevant platforms to feel empowered to weigh in? Because I think that's one of the big challenges. People are busy, as I've recently said, going about their business, doing the groceries, and tonight it's my son's birthday, and tomorrow I've got this important promotion. I don't care about these other issues. Let somebody else worry about them. But everybody has to worry about them. So what are your thoughts? What are some tips that you could give to get people to feel empowered in the same way that you've gone out and put your neck out there with your voice?
I think people, they really need to accept the fact that if they want to change society, they have no choice but to get themselves involved.
Right.
Everybody has a personal life. I have a personal life. You have a personal life. But we're also vocally and actively denouncing the societal ills that contribute to all sorts of human rights abuses, right? And people are selfish. They need to acknowledge that as well. You cannot be selfish and demand things be handed to you and then complain when it's not.
And
you can't do that.
And have others carry the burden of the big fights for you, right?
That's
while
right.
you sit in the safety. And I don't mean just physical safety, right? There's also sort of the herd-like safety of not saying something that is politically incorrect, right? Whereas when you step out and say, no, here are my views, of course you're going to get blowback. And that is unsafe because we're herd animals. We're a social species. We like to belong to the group. And so they like to sort of sit in their quiet existence and let somebody else carry the burden. And that's, I think it's more than just they're busy or lazy. It's actually cowardly, right?
I was just about to say that. Yes, it's cowardly. And they know it too. That's the thing.
Yeah.
They know it. And they're so insecure to come out and say that, this is wrong. You cannot do this. It affects not just me, but it affects everybody else in society. And not many are willing to do that because they're afraid. They're both afraid and insecure.
Right.
They don't know how to empower themselves, And a lot of people, they're also very sheltered. And sheltered people, it's hard for them to perceive reality
right.
the way those who have been affected by religion, And so that's the reason why we have to, as a person who is writing about these problems, only thing I can encourage is to do your homework, to read the facts, and accept the facts. Because the moment a person accepts a fact, they cannot be like, okay, look, the most political correct thing to do is to keep your mouth shut because
right.
you don't want to offend people. Because
right.
then they will see themselves as being being very, quite frankly, stupid.
Right.
And that will kind of embarrass themselves. They will embarrass themselves, and it'll kind of give them the push that they need to come out publicly.
Right. Have you had some people in your own personal life who had been disengaged from some of these important discussions, who as a result of seeing your lead, you've empowered them to get engaged?
Me personally, no.
No, okay.
No. And but there are a lot of people that tell me to not do what I'm doing because once again, I am a South Asian woman, and if, for me to be assertive is
Right.
like a big no-no.
You should
It's
be
sensitive.
pretty and be quiet, right?
Exactly. You know, I
Yeah.
should like lose my tongue
Yes.
because there's no point in having a tongue if you can't talk,
Yeah, and in
right?
French, there's an expression which I've maybe mentioned on a few shows, which I'll say it in French and then I'll translate it. Sois belle et tais-toi. Be pretty and shut your mouth, right?
There you go.
And so, yeah, but I mean, that's of course not just the South East Asian problem. It's a problem in many patriarchal societies.
It's a global
It's a global problem,
problem.
right? So you earlier you just you mentioned about some of these folks that you're talking about live sheltered lives. They don't know the facts. And we recently elected the sheltered person of the century, the king of the sheltered,
Justin Trudeau.
Justin Trudeau, but he's got beautiful, beautiful hair. Although some say
He
that
does.
my hair might actually be prettier than his, or maybe not, or maybe now it's too gray. Who
I
knows?
agree. Yeah, it's just like it has like that silver, that
That wisdom.
silver. Yeah, it's very complimentary to your eyes,
Well, thank you.
your face,
Well,
you
well,
know, and
well.
the beard too. So.
Oh my goodness, I like this woman. But tell me, what are your thoughts on him? I know, one of the really interesting things about being friends with a lot of people and a very heterogeneous group of people is that I just have to every day open my Facebook account and sort of watch the comments on my wall. And it's just breathtaking, right? I mean, some people, the position is Harper was worse than the Taliban. He was a reincarnation of the Nazis. He was a dictator that had to be, extricated from Canadian politics. And of course, others don't think so. And then when it comes to Justin Trudeau, some believe that he is probably the dumbest person potentially that has ever existed. Others think that his boyhood charisma and his abs and his pretty hair. Is what Canada needs. So where do you fall on this? And then how do you tie it to some of the issues that are closest to your heart? Now that Pretty Boy is in power, how do you think he'll fare on some of these issues?
I think the reason why the Conservatives lost is because what they did is they made what they do is they're opportunists. Every politician is an opportunist. So whatever the Conservatives support, the Liberals will oppose it.
Right.
Whatever the Liberals support, the Conservatives will oppose it, and it just goes back and forth. And the main reason why Justin Trudeau won was because he's very charming. You know, he's very charming, and he's playing on people's emotions, and that registered a lot with a lot of Canadians. And Stephen Harper, he has a really bad reputation. First of all, he was the only prime minister in the history of Commonwealth to be found in contempt of the parliament. He's anti-science. He muzzled a lot of scientists.
In
And
terms of
on
the
top of
climate change and stuff like that? Yes.
and he also economically speaking, there was certainly he certainly did kind of put Canada in a bit of a recession, because the loonie it just dropped, you know, it just dropped big time, and on top of that, the conservative members, a lot of controversy, a lot of criminal behavior. And Canada, with the reputation that it has as a liberal democracy, Canadians felt that they were their reputation was being, you know, destroyed by the Harper government. And then what Harper did was he's like, okay, wait, he's gonna acknowledge that the issue with the niqab, right? And what he did is I know that he knows, and the liberals know that the niqab, it's a very huge issue. You know, it goes against a liberal democracy and the values of Canadians when it comes to championing equality, and you know, just like, you know, destroying sexism, and you know, like all that stuff, right? All that good stuff.
Right.
And the conservatives, they try to make the niqab a political issue, and it backfired.
Right.
It backfired big time because, as we all know, pseudo liberals define Eastern misogyny, Islamic misogyny, to be specific, as cultural pluralism. I
Right.
think that's what Bob Rae said. Bob Rae, he literally re referred to it as cultural pluralism, and
Right.
I went after him. I sent him a couple of nasty tweets, and it's sad that the liberals will choose to define the niqab based on their contempt for the conservatives,
Right.
rather than acknowledge what it actually imposes on society.
Well, see, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh,
Finish your point.
go
I
ahead.
was going to say that, I think for some of the issues that we both very much care about, Stephen Harper is hardly a charismatic man, right? I mean, he's as charismatic as a doorknob. But then on the other hand, and he's not as pretty as Justin Trudeau and not as svelte, but on the other hand, on some of the issues that you and I care about and that everybody who is a true liberal should care about, if I just very dispassionately look at the positions of each party, never mind the individuals, right? Let's not succumb to the cult of personality. Then on these particular issues, it doesn't mean that I agree with everything with the conservatives, right? I'm very much socially a liberal guy, but I'm very conservative when it comes to foreign policy or economic policy, right? Because as a thinking person, I'm able to pick and choose which issues which party does better on, right? So when it comes to the niqab, no, the liberals are wrong. When it comes to cohorting with every single imaginable Islamist under the sun, one party is a lot more careful than the other, right? I mean, Justin Trudeau has never met an Islamist that he didn't love, right? And we could name them. I mean, he's gone as a plenary speaker to a conference that is filled with unbelievably problematic people who are perfectly antithetical to every liberal tenet that you and I could generate right now. When somebody tried to argue that, I think it was honor killings and female genital mutilation is barbaric, he got offended that such a word could be used, right? So the removal of clitorises was not offensive, but calling it barbaric, that's offensive. Well, guess what? That offends me. And so from my perspective, I don't care about how unattractive Harper is or how attractive the other guy is. There are issues that are important when it comes to maintaining Canada as a secular liberal democracy. Now, if Justin Trudeau proves to be able to be a defender of those values, then I'm behind him. But frankly, based on what I've seen of him, I think we're in for a rough ride.
And in fact, as you said earlier, he is sheltered. He's a pretty boy, and the only way that sheltered people will learn is if they actually experience the consequences of Islamism within Canada. And it pains me to say that, because they will not do something until they see real results of Islamism. You know, they want proof within Canada that Islamism is dangerous, because people generally want to believe the best in everything and everybody. But that is a very naive approach to politics. Now, that's a reason why, for the first time in my life, I actually had to contemplate whether I should vote Liberals or the CPC. And then I realized that if the Conservatives have another go at this, financially, like economically, it's going to impact Canada negatively. Socially, the same result. The reputation will just keep going down. But as for the liberals, Justin being the charming guy that he is, I think he simply wanted to be prime minister, so he did all these rounds of cultural appeasement. But then, essentially, I think by the time he starts doing real work within the office, he's going to kind of backtrack.
So you're thinking
reality will hit him soon. Hopefully sooner than later.
Do you think it will hit him before he signs the order to bring in 25,000 non-vetted refugees from Syria?
I don't think so, no, because liberals are known for their big supporters of bringing in much refugees as possible, and they will. I don't think so, no.
Justin Trudeau
is not going to. Reality will not hit him in that context. Particularly, no, it's not going to hit him. But I think he will see the overall threat of Islamism soon.
I mean, you know, you and I, we're sitting here having a chat. We're both products of the generosity of Canada, right? And
yes.
That we both escaped, right? I mean, you escaped Sri Lanka and the war there. I escaped the Lebanese civil war. And so some people might at first glance think, well, what are these guys talking about? I mean, they're here because of the generosity of the open borders that Canada. Now, the difference, I mean, my defense of our position would be, I am all for letting in people of all ilk, all religions, all colors, brown, purple, mauve, green, believers and non-believers, on one condition: you all leave your hateful ideologies, whatever they are, at the doorstep. And once you come in here, your number one requirement is to pledge allegiance to our Western liberal secular values. What you do in the privacy of your home that doesn't harm a third party, hey, go for it. But once you come into our country, that's what makes us all common. That's what makes you, who's darker than me, no different than me, because we both share liberal secular values. The problem is that multiculturalism, as defined by his equally idiotic father, is people incorrectly make the mistake of thinking that multiculturalism means pluralism. Right, when you say, look, this is a multicultural city. Multiculturalism as a political philosophy is profoundly inept. That's why we have the problem in the West. Because it says that it is wrong, it is racist of you to defend your own values. Rather, you should let people in and allow them to flourish, quote, within their own ghettos and oases, because who are we to judge their cultural practices? And what it does is it basically castrates people from being able to say, hey, guess what? Throwing acid on women's faces, well, that's probably not a good idea. Cutting off the clitorises of women, well, you know, we sort of don't like that in Canada. And so people become conflicted. So am I allowed to say that it is wrong to cover women so that their identities are lost under a niqab? Or is it progressive for me to? And I see it in some of my colleagues who are otherwise perfectly intelligent people, but who are completely incapable of navigating through that moral landmines, if you'd like. And I think that's the problem, is that sure, let in Syrian refugees, because most of them are lovely people. But the reality is, I don't know who's lovely and who's not. And between now and December, you're not going to be able to vet who is lovely or not. And so you are basically risking the future of everybody so that you appear progressive. Well, what are your thoughts on this long-winded analysis?
Multiculturalism. It's a good thing when you can appreciate the good cultures.
Right.
But to turn around and tell me that FGM and the niqab and all these ugly practices are also part of multiculturalism that deserves tolerance, that just kind of makes my brain, you know, short circuit, because
right.
I cannot tolerate it because I love life and I value human rights above idiotic sentiments, cultural sentiments.
Right.
And at no point will I say that, you know, that misogyny and expressions of misogyny like the niqab should be tolerated because multiculturalism.
Right.
And people need to get in touch with reality, because if every single Canadian woman were expected to wear the niqab because of, you know, whatever belief, there isn't a single Canadian that's going to stand by and be like, you know, yeah, let's do this, let's appreciate this. You know, it's part of culture. You know, it's part of somebody's belief. But then when we see immigrants doing it, we suddenly have to accept it. We suddenly have to appreciate it and tolerate it.
Right.
Because we don't want to offend them and make them feel like they're not part of the Canadian society.
Well, and I think that if the immigrants in question were blonde Swedes wearing the niqab, then the so-called progressives would be perfectly happy in criticizing this, right? Because it is actually quite progressive to criticize all religions that are, or all practices, cultural practices that are somehow linked to the white man, right? And so therefore, if you took the exact same practice, if you took the niqab and said, you know what, we're going to create an alternate bizarro universe where it's really blonde Swedes who do this, well, then people would feel very, very comfortable saying, my God, what a bunch of lunatics to be subjugating women to these kinds of issues. But when it comes to these cultural practices of our brown people, colored people, people of color, then, of course, all bets are off in the victimology poker. You're not allowed to touch them. They hold the top hands. And I really see it because I actually, as you might imagine, I do engage a lot of people, both publicly and privately. And you literally see how they are completely stifled. They're unable to navigate through this. They really don't know what to correctly think. Is it appropriate for me to criticize female genital mutilation, or is it racist? Well, once you're actually debating those two things, you've lost the plot. Your moral compass is broken. The fact that I have to come along and guide you through that decision, it means that we're in trouble.
And it's lower expectations.
Right.
Because people of color, you know, don't set the bar up too high because, you know, they don't know what they're doing. And that is essentially what racism is.
Exactly right.
And they don't understand. Well, I won't say that they don't understand it. They just don't want. They're so obsessed with not offending people. If you do not offend people, nothing will be accomplished. Nothing will be realized.
Well,
you have to offend in order to educate. You must offend.
Let's take in a context of non-religion. Let's take science, right? I mean, science, big scientific breakthroughs usually happen where the old paradigm is utterly obliterated, right? I mean, so discontinuous innovations in science is where you come up with completely a radical new perspective to view the world, right? Theory of evolution is the powerful scientific theory that it is because it allowed us to shed some unbelievable misconceptions about how biological forms come to be and so on. So by definition, if you're doing, say, important scientific work, you're, quote, offending a lot of people, right? I mean, as a matter of fact, there is a study that was done, I don't have the exact reference, that looked at Nobel Prize-winning work. And turns out that works. So let's say the scientific paper that led to a Nobel Prize is often some of the papers that are most rejected as they go through the peer review process. Why? Because they're so radical. They're proposing something so different, so contrary to the orthodoxy that everybody rejects them because everybody is, quote, in that sense, offended. And yet they turn out to be the correct theories. So everything is about challenging orthodoxy. That's why we have free speech, right? I mean, if my free speech is to tell you, wow, you're really pretty, Aki, well, who doesn't support free speech? But if free speech is to tell you, you know what, Aki, your views are completely grotesque, That's why we need free speech. And so I'm always amazed when I see, again, let's take, for example, the Je suis Charlie stuff, right? The Charlie Hebdo. The number of, quote, liberals who were on the wrong side of the debate, breathtaking, right?
When it came to Charlie Hebdo, I did not realize until then just how illiberal the Canadian society has become. They were victim blaming,
Right.
and I was so enraged. There isn't, I was speechless. I was so angry that I became speechless because I could not accept that this is the Canada that I live in today in 2015. Usually whenever you see the conservative misogynists, telling women to, to put on more clothes, and slut shaming and all that. And the liberals would, immediately fight back saying like stop blaming the victim. If a person is raped, it's not the victim's fault. It's always the attacker's, right? But then when it came to Charlie Hebdo, they're like, oh, it's definitely the cartoonist's fault because, they wore their free speech skirt a little too. A little too high,
Right.
and they deserve it because they asked for it.
You know, it's so funny because I've used that exact same analogy. You know, to use analogies is often a very powerful tool when you're trying to corner somebody into understanding your position. Because oftentimes you use an analogy that you a priori know that that particular analogy, the person that you're debating with, is on board. And then you demonstrate that the structure of this other issue that they're not agreeing with you on is logically identically equivalent. So if we say if P then Q, and then I demonstrate through some other form that this other issue is also if P then Q. So if we take your example with the rape, right? If you sexually trigger me by wearing sexy clothes, then I rape you and it's your fault. That the structure of that sentence logically is identical to if Charlie Hebdo writers trigger me by writing something that offends me and therefore I kill you, it's Charlie Hebdo. I mean, it is impossible to not see that they are identical in their structure. And so that's a really powerful tool to corner these people. And so I'm very glad that you've, because I've thought about the exact, and I use all types of analogical reasoning. And usually, most people have too much pride to admit to your face that they've been defeated, but you could see it in their eyes that they've been defeated.
And also, a lot of people, because you cannot argue with that analogy,
Right.
that's when they start, throwing the racist
Yes.
insults that you're a racist. You are you have you have no you have no right to right to lampoon Islam. You're an Islamophobe. This
Right.
is Islamophobic because they have nothing else to say. They have nothing logical
Yes.
to say.
Have you seen my I've uncovered a bunch of white male bigots YouTube clip? I think I've tagged you on that one,
Yes,
haven't
you did.
I?
Yes, I've seen
Yeah.
that one. Yeah,
And
there's a lot of white supremacists out
I
there.
know,
No, it's
and the beautiful thing is that a lot of them are coming on my show. So I've got the white male bigot Sarah Hader on my show. I've got the white male bigot Aki Mutali on my show. White male bigot Ali Rizvi's gonna come on.
And
Faisal.
Faisal too, right?
If I, so I'm gonna go through this whole list. Eventually, I'll get to maybe Ayaan Hirsi Ali and others. I mean, again, it's remarkable, right? Because I mean, obviously, you're not a white male bigot, so you must be, in your case, an Islamophobe, right? So you can't be racist in the skin color sense because you're a
I'm
person
a
of
native
color.
informant.
You're a native
Native
informant.
informant.
Exactly. And somebody like Ayaan Hirsi Ali is what, a house, not Arab because she's not really actually Somali, but what would be her insult?
A combination of native informant
Right.
versus Uncle Tom.
Uncle Tom, that's true.
It's
That's a good
Uncle
one, yes.
Tom, yes.
And I think Majid Nawaz, which if you want, we could talk about, and also I want to talk about Reza Aslan, your favorite guy.
Oh, yes, my favorite little unicorn.
But in the Majid, I think, was called the porch monkey.
Porch monkey, yes.
Yes. I mean, imagine, I mean, now isn't it incredible that the person who's levying that insult is usually a white male who the irony escapes him how unbelievably racist he's being in hurling that insult. He doesn't see that somehow.
Yeah, because racism is simply an offense committed by white people.
Exactly.
That's a new age definition of racism.
Yes.
Power, power and bigotry equals white.
Exactly.
And this is being touted by a lot of Easterners. You know, they see white, they immediately see bigot, racist, sexist, misogynist,
Right.
whatever label, whatever ugly label you want to name, white people are under it. You know, it's laughable.
How about the Indian caste system? That doesn't seem to involve whites, and yet it is institutionalized racism, right?
Yes,
But
exactly.
somehow, probably, the Indian caste system must be due to white British colonialism, even though it precedes it by thousands of years.
A lot of people actually made that
Is
argument.
that true? Wow,
A lot of people
I
made
made
that
that up.
argument. They're like,
Oh,
"Oh, there's no caste system before the British colonialism." And I'm like, "Excuse me, can you like say that again?"
unbelievable.
Exactly. It's unbelievable. It's ludicrous.
Right.
I cannot understand, for the love of life, I can't understand how this obsession with vilifying the white people because of their colonial past. Because people of color, we've never, you know, colonized
No.
or you know, we don't do that, right? We've never done that before. Of course, because before white people came to the East, brown people simply lived in harmony, or they did not live at all. You
It's
know,
gone.
our life did not start until the white people
Yes.
discovered us.
Well, it's the noble savage argument, right? It's the
Exactly.
anthropologist of peace, right? Until whites created this whole idea of war, people, native people of all sorts on the four globe walked around singing John Lennon, Imagine, a lot of Bob Marley, Could You Be Love? It was just one big utopic peace fest. What's the 1969? Woodstock. It was the Woodstock fest all over the world. And you know, this is touted in universities, right? I mean, this is something that people are taught, that, I mean, war really started with the evil white man. I mean, it's just breathtaking. Now, I come from the Middle East, and I could tell you that, you know, racism in the Middle East, for example, towards black people, is just breathtaking. I mean, it would make the racism that people complain about in the United States or Canada seem, I mean, trivial, right? I mean, it's institutionalized in the language, right? You know, abid, okay, abid is a black person, but it also sort of means slave. Right, so there's a joining of the two words, right? So Abdullah, the name Abdullah, is slave to God, right? Well, Abid is also a black person. So I mean, it's just laughable that people buy into these narratives. But again, it's because they don't know any better. And I mean, one of the reasons why I'm so keen on having these conversations, you know, I mean, I have a very busy life as a scientist. I mean, I don't need to add more stuff to my plate, but I view it as incumbent on me and others to contribute whatever little we're contributing to hopefully get people to be exposed to information. Because ultimately, and I think you'll agree, the dangers here are not so much from a radical jihadist who blows things. It's the battle of ideas, right? Once you lose that battle, everything else, you know, falls apart very quickly. And that's why they try to find ways to stifle the debate. Because if the debate is lost, it's all lost for them, right?
And if you dare to expose them to information, then immediately you're struck down, you're silenced, you get called a racist. Once again, every time you are right and you're presenting evidence, it makes you a bigot in their book. By their definition, you're the bigot because here you are exposing information to them that would hopefully educate them, your aim is to educate them, but their aim is to silence you.
Right. Well, I'll give you a great example, and I think I might have mentioned it in some other show, and I also had a YouTube clip about it. So, you know, I mean, of course I criticize Islam, but I criticize religion in general. I mean, I'm of Jewish background. I'll criticize some of the quacky things that I see Orthodox Jews doing. You know, the Jews that won't sit next to a woman on a plane, and then they delay everybody because we have to play musical chairs because a guy, you know, God forbid he should sit next to a dirty woman, or, you know, all sorts of wacky things. Of course, it's not, you know, religious stupidity is not reserved for one religion. Now, when I criticize, so let's take three examples. So I criticize some, you know, unbelievable idiocy from some Jewish folks. Nobody says anything. Everybody says, wow, yeah, great. They like it on Facebook. Good stuff, Dr. Sand. I criticize some wacky Republican senator for being an evolution denier, right? I mean, Ben Carson, Dr. Ben Carson, yeah. Neurosurgeon, you know, thinks evolution is the work of Satan and so on, right? We criticize that. My God, of course you should criticize him for his stupid Christian beliefs and evolution denying. You're a progressive. Now, here's a third example, which happened, and I've documented, and you may have seen it. I posted on Facebook a clip from a Iraqi astronomer, an astronomer, not an astrologist, right, scientist, saying that, no, here's a verse, whatever, in the Quran that says that the earth is flat, and I go by my book, and I don't go by the... you know, science, the Zionist, whatever it is. I posted this, no comments, no editorializing, no interpretation. What do I get as a response? A fellow scientist, an evolutionist, a white woman who lives in Northern California writes, why are you doing this? Why are you, don't you think these people are suffering enough and are marginalized? I mean, think about how extraordinary that is, right? A fellow scientist was not offended that a scientist was arguing that the earth was flat. She was offended that I was pointing to the scientist who thought the earth. So that's it. The reason why I keep giving that example is because it perfectly captures the slow demise of the West. If a scientist is unable to navigate through this issue properly, we're doomed, right? It's over.
That's right. So once again, the offensive part was the exposure to truth and or rather addressing the bigotry than a person, than a man of science claiming that the earth is flat.
Right.
And let alone, and this was an astronaut, you said?
Astronomer. So a physicist.
And this is an astronomer saying this.
Exactly.
And the colossal scale of bigotry is completely ignored.
Right.
But you pointting that out is somehow offensive to this other scientist.
Right. Who's marginalized.
Because they're marginalized. And once again, they're conflating one thing with another.
Right.
You know, you were pointing out the fact that it's kind of wrong for a scientist to say to deny evidence based on religious belief, and then what the what your she was your friend you said
she's a Facebook friend. I know her from Facebook.
So your friend conflates that to anti-Muslim bigotry
right
within the West.
Is that incredible?
It doesn't make sense for a person to be a scientist and then becomes to make such an irrational argument.
Now, here's what I think. Here's why I think she does it. It's because the most scientists in the West, many of them are at this point non-believers in a religion. But I argue that they, if you like, they've replaced official religious dogma by secular, non-religious dogma, which they pray to, which they self-flagellate to. And that's they pray at the altar of non-offense. They pray at the altar of tolerance. They pray at the altar of tolerating the intolerable. And so they and because of that, because their belief system is also removed from evidence, right? I mean, I could believe in some religious thing that is completely devoid of reality, or I could believe in this alternate secular, right, non-religion, political correctness, cultural relativism, that again, there is tons of evidence that falsifies those positions, but because it has now become part of my non-religious identity to which I pray, I don't want to hear evidence. So in a sense, that scientist friend of mine is truly no different than the religious Jew or Christian or Muslim or Hindu that is foregoing evidence, right? And I guess
That's a sad realization, isn't it?
it is a sad, but hopefully
Disappointing. It's disappointing.
that we're doing this. I mean, I don't expect that we're going to make a huge impact in the world, but this is why I always say everybody has to be involved. I mean, even if all you do is like a Facebook thing. In one show recently, I don't remember which one, I was mentioning that people are even afraid to like something that I might post. And I mean, I think I'm very reasoned when I post things. I'm very, I think very polite, but they're so afraid. They're so unsure about their moral compass. Now, the reason why I know that is because oftentimes they will write to me privately and say, "Oh, by the way, my God, thank you for that. I so support you." I say, "Oh, but so why don't you just take 2 seconds to like it on Facebook? Because then that sends a signal to others that there is support for this position." "Well, I don't feel comfortable because maybe my career." So imagine if you are so afraid, right? You live in supposedly a free society, but you self-censor to the point, not that you are putting out ideas, but just liking the message is too terrifying. Well, that basically suggests that we're really down the road of no free speech, right?
That's right. That's right. They have compromised free speech in a sense because they claim that, okay, it's okay to say A, B, and C, but it's not okay to say the rest because then it'll offend people, it'll offend the snowflakes.
Right.
And and I don't know. These it's so exceedingly frustrating to live in a world where free speech is being censored. I mean, think about it. Free speech itself is being censored. That means there is no free speech.
Exactly. Well, it's like saying basically I'm a virgin who's had 4 children, right? I mean, the words don't go together, right? Now, let's see if we can maybe infuse some optimism into this discussion. Do you foresee things changing? Do you think that there are a set of realities that can be implemented, or some cataclysmic things that can happen that could redress the ship in the right direction? Or do you think we're just gonna die a slow death by a thousand cuts?
The last part.
You really, yeah? You think we're doomed?
We are technically doomed because when it comes to human rights, it's so simple to understand. I get to live my life, say whatever I want, you get to do the same. But somehow there are restrictions and human rights are being conformed to the bigotry of one person because they don't like, they don't like what the other person is saying.
Right.
So when you're conforming free speech and human rights to the bigotry of society, then we are essentially suffering an inevitable, slow and painful, unnecessary demise.
So, but in this, I'm sorry, in the same way that you thought that, say, a pretty boy empty suit might be exposed to reality when he takes on his job, and that will alter his otherwise sheltered snowboarding life. Do you then think that there could be something at the societal level, collectively, in the same way that there might be an awakening in Hairboy, maybe there could also be an awakening collectively in people when they are exposed to realities that threaten their freedom? I mean, because if we don't hold on to that hope, then what is the point of having this conversation, right? I mean, if we're doomed, then we should have just gone jogging today, no?
That's right. That's right. And I think the worst part about all this is when people lose hope and they just completely end their engagement.
Right.
You know, they have to we have to actively pursuing these problems and addressing them, because if nobody is willing to address them, we might as well just go jogging, as you said.
Exactly.
There is absolutely no point. So we have to, for those that do see the problems, those that acknowledge reality for what it is, it's our job to kind of keep doing what we're doing. And hopefully one day it might come across someone with power,
Right.
and they might do something about it. And it's not a promise, but there's a chance. There's a slight chance. And we do live in an information era. So personally, I believe that every single person has a duty to address these issues if they want to have a change. If they don't want change and they keep making very regressive arguments, then they have no right to complain,
Right.
and they have to accept accountability for what they are creating.
Right.
And what they are creating is a world of censorship and defense for the tyrant.
Right.
And they have to
So
take
there
it,
is
and they have to
hope.
take
So there is hope.
there's a
You're
slight bit of hope.
stepping back. I mean, I need to leave people off with some hope. I didn't like your earlier answer that we were doomed.
There's a slight bit of hope,
Right.
but in the process of it actually, taking effect, there's going to be hundreds of thousands of unnecessary suffering.
I agree. You're absolutely right. What are some of the things as we sort of come close to the end of the show, or we could go as long as you want, but what are some of the things that you're working on now? Are there sort of is your goal to just keep writing these wonderfully incisive articles, or is there something else? Are you thinking of doing a book? Are you thinking of setting up a foundation? What are some of the things that are simmering in Aki world?
For me, I will definitely keep writing, because for me it's very difficult to articulate myself when I'm speaking.
You're
I
doing a
tend
good
to
job.
stutter. Thank you, thank you. It's a bit of a practice for me, because I tend to stutter and I say a lot of
It's
but
just
then,
it's my good looks that are intimidating you. That's
yes,
the
and the beard, like you
problem.
have like the whole lumber sexual thing going on right now. So.
Don't worry, my wife won't see this, so don't worry. Keep speaking.
So, yeah, for me, I'm going to keep writing, and one day if I can have more time to actually create a foundation,
Right.
or just do something a little bit more, I want to do I do essentially I do want to contribute a little bit more to my cause rather than just writing. It's just that I don't have enough time right now.
Right.
I have a lot of personal things going on, and so the only thing I can keep doing right now is just to keep writing. That will never stop.
Good.
But one
Well,
day in the future, maybe like I might consider committing to a foundation and doing my work through that,
and that would
you
be
know.
what? Defense of women's rights around the world? What do you think? What would be your vision of the type of thing that you'd like to focus on? Is it freedom of speech? Is it women's right? Is it both?
It will be about a free thinking society,
Right.
to something along that lines, secular values, women's rights, because essentially, if we want to combat dangerous ideas, then we need to express the issues within religion, because everything that I write, it's not just about religious abuse. Mainly it's about religious abuse. But when it comes to human rights abuses, it's not just limited to that. So it has to be about, something to do with the freedom of expression and cultures and religions.
Right.
I don't know. I want to cram all of them into one place.
Right.
And so this way, there won't be any confused people. A lot of people on my Facebook, even though I've deactivated it right now, a lot of people, they would message me and saying like, oh, but like, what does that have to do with this? I mean,
right.
It has nothing to do with Islam. And I'm like, but I never said that,
Right.
I only criticize Islam.
Yes.
It's about a whole, there's like a world of problems that needs to be addressed if people are to live equally and happily.
Right.
And that cannot happen when nobody is, doing anything about it. So.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, no, go on, go on.
I was going to say, I think, one of the additional, elements to our respective voices is that our personal histories lend us additional vision and credence amongst the West, right? Because the typical person who's never been exposed to some of the realities that you and I might have been exposed to, and others who emigrate to Canada and the West, they don't really appreciate, right? I mean, they're spoiled in that sense. I mean, the king of being spoiled again goes back to Justin Trudeau, right? Who's got no conception of some of the realities of where you and I might come from, and so that's why I think that there is a unique ability in communicating some of these messages from people's lived experiences, right? So, I mean, someone like Ayaan Hirsi Ali, despite the fact that she gets, criticized the way that she does, I mean, who better than a black Somali ex-Muslim woman who's experienced female genital mutilation than to speak about some of these issues? And that's why she becomes profoundly dangerous to the other camp, because just her identity, her lived experience is problematic, right? Because she's not Sam Harris, the white boy who lives in California, right? And so it's really important that voices like ours be heard, because not only do we bring in, hopefully, knowledge, but we also bring in our personal experiences. And people love to hear about personal narratives, right? Oftentimes, when I speak, let's say, about my personal experience escaping Lebanon, that's what people remember. They don't remember all the fancy academic or philosophical discussions. They remember, boy, this guy has a compelling personal story, and we should listen to him, if only because of that personal story. And so somebody like you who knows what it is to not live in a free society, who could then argue against the dangers of forces that are trying to reduce our freedom, hopefully people will increasingly listen to your voice. Are there any things you want to plug? Your Twitter, do you have a public page, your articles, anything? Because people need to hear your voice more.
So I do write for The Nation. Okay. It's based in Pakistan. And I'm very active on Twitter. It's Aki Mudali.
So
AKIMUTHALI.
And I'll put links to these at the bottom of the clip when I post it. Anything else you want to promote or say before we leave off today?
I've had a lot of fun.
So did I.
You had a lot of interesting questions, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you.
And I feel really proud to have had a chance to come on your show.
Oh, you're very kind.
Very interesting.
You're very kind. Thank you so much. So I'll be probably putting it up later today, and I'll send you a flag once it's up. Thank you so much, Aki.
Thank you, Dad.
Cheers, bye.
Take care.